This podcast was recorded on the date indicated with the link. The views and opinions expressed herein are as of the date recorded and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities. Such views and opinions may differ from those of DoubleLine Capital or its affiliates and are subject to change without notice. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide updates or changes. Welcome to Monday Morning Minutes, hosted by DoubleLine's fixed income asset allocation strategists and portfolio managers, Samuel Lau and Jeffrey Mayberry. Please direct any comments and suggestions to minutes@doubleline.com or see us on Twitter at @DLineMinutes.
Welcome to this week's episode of DoubleLine Monday Morning Minutes. I'm Jeff Mayberry with Sam Lau.
Hey, hey.
We're recording just after the close, January 6th. First full week of the, or I guess it wasn't even a full week, but felt like a full week, a first business week of the year in the books. Why don't we get into it? It was kind of the inverse of what happened in 2022 so far. It has happened in 2023.
Yeah, I mean, I hope you just didn't jinx us with all that. But we're off to a good start here on the year. For the most part, the traditional financial assets are in the green here. So let's start out with the S&P 500, up 1.5% on the week. 10 of the 11 sectors all in the positive, with energy just the kind of the laggard of those positives, just up a basis point. But I'll take that as a positive number right there, given the backdrop of 2022.
I'll give you the BIP there.
Yeah, given that backdrop that we just had, I mean, anything that's positive is good, right? So even though energy was the big winner last year, up I can't really remember, but up pretty significantly, let's just say. I want to say around 50 or 60% even on that year. We got comm services right now up 5.25% for the week. The only laggard in terms of negative numbers here is the healthcare sector, down 17 basis points for the week. We'll see if that can turn it. We can turn that around in the remaining 51 weeks of the year. I think there's a pretty good chance of that. And in terms of just at least the amount of time that it has to kind of catch up that 17 basis points. Looking across the large and small cap, Russell 1000 for the large cap up 1.6, Russell 2000 up 1.9, so kind of neck to neck on this first 4 days of the trading days of the year here. Moving in terms of growth versus value, value off to a stronger start yet again. Russell 1000 value up 2.7% and Russell 1000 growth up half a point. With regards to the Treasury curve, looks like had a move down in yields across the board here. 2-year yields starting off or closing the first trading week of the year at 4.26%. That's in 17 basis points from last Friday, December 30th. And then we've got the 10-year Treasury closing the week at 3.6% after having closed the week at 3.9%. And then the bond at 3.7% in terms of the yield as of the close. It did not close above 4 last year. It made it to 3.96. I know you and I were talking about that in the last Monday Morning Minutes podcast. We were wondering if it would make it above 4 again for the year. And it looks like at least through the close, it did not. So starting out there with on the right foot in terms of bonds. And in fact, when I look at the Bloomberg U.S. bond aggregate, it's the best performer this week. So on a week-to-date basis, it's up about 2.2%. Every sector that we cover within the fixed income, this little small universe that we look at, is in the green. IG corporate credit is up 3%. Looking at agency mortgage-backed securities, that's the next best performer within the cohort underlying the ag. That's up 2.25%. And then Treasury is up about 1.9%. But even when we look at some of the heavier duty credit sectors out there, high yield corporate credit up 2.6%. EM debt, it's off to a good start as well on this on this new year, up 2.5%, and bank loans up 2%. So definitely a strong start for both the fixed income as well as the U.S. equity market there, with, again, the ag taking the lead at 2.2% positive performance. Switching gears into physical assets here, we have commodities. It's the other way around, bro, versus the first two asset classes that we just talked about, and also other way around, bro, against the year of 2022. It's off to a negative start here, down 4% on the year. And it looks, for the most part, across the board, you saw the ags largely in the red. Industrial metals, for the most part, in the red, with looks like copper and nickel having a good performance there. But copper and zinc. But when I take a look at nickel, nickel's down almost 7% on the week. Nat gas continues to feel the pain. It's down 17% on the front month futures contract, down below 4%. We closed 2022 with a dollar price of 4.5 on Nat gas front month future. Right now it's at 3.73 per million BTUs there. Looking at WTI crude oil, it dropped below 80. It's at $73.69. It just been hanging on to a $80 price per barrel at year end, but now we're about 8% down versus where we were last Friday. In terms of gold, gold still maintained its ability to hold above 1800. It's getting closer to that 1900 mark now after being up 2.5%. It's closed the week now at $1,871.90 a troy ounce there on gold. But overall, it looks like across these broader sectors or broader asset classes that we look at, commodities is the only negative performer, because Bitcoin, being representing the entire digital crypto space, is up. It's up 2% on the week over week basis. It's just shy of $17,000 a Bitcoin there. So let's see if we can keep up this momentum, at least in those three positive performers, and turn it around for the Bloomberg Commodity Index.
I thought it was interesting as you were speaking, Sam. I was like recalling back to last year, and the highest point in the ag was negative off the first day of the year, and continued that negative trend and never went positive. So having a positive close to the week is something new for the ag. And S&P went positive for the very first day of the year of last year on January 3rd, 2022, and then went negative and then stayed negative the rest of the year. So to get some at least some positive prints here is further reinforce my not jinxing of the markets, is that we're putting in some positive performance at least to start the year.
I'm feeling pretty good after talking about this this little market roundup. But why don't you kick off and tell us where we are in terms of the macro front? How should we feel on that side?
Yeah, the macro front was, it was a mixed bag. On Wednesday, we did get the ISM manufacturing number for December. That came in at 48.4. That was just slightly below estimates. Still below 50. Still showing contractionary on the manufacturing side. But it was the estimate was 48.5, so just a slight miss there. On the more positive outlook, is the JOLTS job openings numbers also came out on Wednesday. Those numbers came in at 10.458 million job openings for November. That was well above expectations of 10.05 million. So much more, or many more job openings than what people were expecting. And again, that shows kind of the strength of the labor market. Later then, again on Wednesday, we did get the Fed meeting minutes. Nothing too shocking there, really just reinforced the idea that the Fed wants to be at higher rates for longer, and that they're not anticipating any cuts to the Fed funds rate in 2023, despite what the market is saying. And then this morning, we had some more strong numbers from the labor market. Today is Pizza Friday. And so we did get the change in non-farm payroll numbers, the NFP. The number came in at 223,000. It was estimated to be 203, so again, stronger than expectations there. The unemployment rate came in well below expectations. It was expected to be 3.7, came in at 3.5. I think 3.5 is the lowest rate we've had in about 60 years or so. So pretty good, strong number there from the unemployment rate. labor force participation rate actually was up higher than expectations. So it was expected to come in at 62.2, came in at 62.3. So again, labor market strong there. But on the, again, on the downside is the ISM services number that came in, or that came out again this morning. That was expected to be 55. That ISM services number has been pretty strong over the past few months, despite the market, or I guess I could say market with an I, but the S&P Global services number is coming in a little weak. But the ISM services number came in below 50, well below expectations, and settled in at a 49.6. And this is for December. So, you know, you, again, kind of a mixed bag. Labor market still strong, at least on the backwards looking, you know, looking backwards into the unemployment and the payroll numbers for December. But looking, you know, the ISM numbers looking pretty weak. So it'll be interesting to see how things shake out, whether things, how things work out, whether the services numbers kind of bounce back or the labor market tends to weaken. One of the things also that came out was that the, you know, Sam, you and I have talked about the differences between the establishment survey and the household survey, and that there was a lot of talk that the household survey was, or the establishment survey was over-reporting numbers, and that the labor market was not as strong as the establishment survey was saying because the household survey was so weak. But then today we did get some revisions to the household numbers, and that I think that revision was something around in order 700,000 jobs that was being undercounted on the household survey. So that brings those two surveys much more in line, and it really continues to reinforce the fact that the labor market is strong.
Yeah, and that again goes back to one of our mantras there, right? You just got to dig underneath the hood to really dissect the numbers and try to figure out all the moving parts within there. But one interesting thing that you mentioned is, you know, whether or not we'll see a kind of a reversal or just a pop back in the ISM services data next month. Some people are always optimistic, but perhaps they're looking at that surprise shock, negative shock to the expectations for the ISM services. I mean, it's a miss by like almost 5.5 points there to the downside, but people were blaming the weather that we got in the latter half, especially around the holidays across the U.S. that might have negatively affected that. So I guess time will tell. We just have to wait a month to see if we do get a little bit of bounce back in the services. But typically it's not a good sign at all when you have that corroboration between the manufacturing and the services side of these PMIs, both being in contractionary periods. And I should have looked it up, but I do believe this is the second consecutive month, I think, for the manufacturing side being in contraction. So definitely we're seeing some signs of slowing down there outside of the labor market, at least with regards to some of these economic data points that we look at.
Yeah, and you are right. This is the second below 50 for ISM manufacturing, the first below 50 for services.
Okay. All right. So we'll see what the next month holds, as always.
Yep, exactly. And this is why we keep, that's why this is interesting to see kind of what happens. Let's move on to the topic of the week this week. And, you know, one of the things that we've been talking about and, is the yield curve as a recession indicator. If you go back, the twos tens curve is at negative 69 basis points right now. The old academic way of looking at the yield curve is the 3 month to 10 year yield curve. That's actually very negative today at a negative 108. Ended the year last year at 53. So a big inversion there, given that the 10 year yield has fallen this week. That's one of those indicators that has been a perfect 8 for 8 in terms of forecasting recessions. This is the 3 month to 10 year. It's one of those things that Cam Harvey from Duke University is the one who popularized this as a recession indicator. And he's out and been out for the past, 2 or 3 weeks now, saying that he has reason to believe that it's a false signal. So, you know, we're always very hesitant to say that this time is different, but when someone is who has put the model together has become, I guess, finance famous for this model, and they say it's different, then it kind of piqued our interest, I should say, Sam. And Why don't you, you know, give a little background or give a little bit more in depth on what Mr. Harvey's thinking, or I guess Dr. Harvey's thinking here.
Yeah. So what we really picked up on, or at least what I picked up on, was just one of these headlines, which I think at the end, it really ended up being kind of clickbait. But the headline came from a article that came out on Bloomberg on January 4th, 2023. But as you mentioned, that he had been making the rounds prior to this, talking about the same thing. But the reason why I call this, well, the headline itself, it's a quote, "Economist says his indicator that predicted 8 U.S. recessions is wrong this year," end quote. So that, you know, kind of piqued our interest there, and you know, we looked at it. But yeah, you mentioned that Professor Harvey had popularized this idea of linking the term structure of the Treasury yield curve to the prospects for future economic activity there. And he really dissected it and brought it together in his doctoral dissertation back in 1986. For those who may be interested in it, you can find that on Professor Campbell Harvey's website, a la Duke University. It's right up there if you do a little bit of digging, as is the cleaned up version and kind of the shortened version that he published in 1988 for, I want to say, is the Journal of Economic Finance or one of those. But you can find it on the website there. But effectively, he looked at the inversion between the 3-month 10-year. He stated that based on his research, it needed to be inverted for 1/4. And as you and I were kind of talking about it before this episode, you know, it truly is likely 1/4, because when you look at the dissertation, they're looking at using quarterly data only. And we're kind of joking that, you know, this falling between quarter end dates, you know, without really, you know, turning a blind eye to all the data that comes in between those quarters, is pure academia, right? But for listeners that want to listen in terms about the efficacy of these yield curve indicators as a predictor of recession, Jeff and I have a host of podcasts that we've done on the yield curve and its signaling ability for a recession. So two that I'll point out right now are episodes 52, that we recorded on February 11th, 2022, where we go through the various iterations of looking at the term structure of the Treasury yield curve. We look at the 3-month versus the 10-year, the 2-year versus the 10-year, the 5 versus the 30. And I believe we actually also look at the Fed's version, which is the 3-month expected, the expected yield on the 3-month T-bill 18 months forward, versus the current 3-month yield. So we looked at that, and based on our research, our cursory research there, we only went back 6 recessions, but we looked at it that anytime the 3-month 10-year or any of those curves inverted by 5 days or more, we based our assessment on that, and the 3-month 10-year was the best, and it did not have any false positives there as well. So we kind of rounded out Professor Harvey's research perhaps by looking at it on a daily basis versus just at quarter ends there. So kind of necessary as daily practitioners, we have to look at the daily data there. So it does seem to be a good recessionary signal, but we only brought it back down to I want to say the 80s, the late 80s. And then Professor Campbell, when he did this dissertation in 86, had been looking at data between the 60s and the 80s, it worked for that period. I guess no surprise, since that was his dissertation, and that's what made it popular. But it's nice to know that in the 4 recessions since that period and since that dissertation came out, there have been 0 false positives there as well. And it's pretty funny. There's one article I was reading while I was going through the research there, and it kind of said that he himself was a little bit nervous about the you know, the accuracy of this, because it's the idea that once a model is shown and popularized, then its ability to continue with that forecast changes over time because people start to adjust their behavior. But he was quite happy to see after his dissertation that it continued to hold. So that was a little interesting little tidbit that I thought was interesting. But a couple of the other episodes that we did, there's episode 59. I think that's another good episode to look at. That was recorded on April 4th of this April first of this year. And the difference there is we also look at the real yield curve. So adjusting the yield curve for inflation and looking at that as a recession indicator. And if we still have Charles from France listening on to this podcast, as he was in the early part of 2022, then a hat tip there, because that was a question that came in for the topic of the week from him. So getting into it, based on this article that we saw from the Bloomberg article, basically there's a quote in there that he says his yield curve indicator has gone red. It's been 8 for 8 in forecasting recession since 1968 with no false alarms. But he does have a few reasons to believe, however, that the yield curve signal may be flashing a false signal this time around. And some of the reasons that he provided for that was, reason number one was, I think I alluded to it already, there's adjustments in risky behavior once you see that the yield curve inverts. This relationship between the term structure of the Treasury curve to economic activity is so well known now that it could impact behavior, let's say, and it could induce companies as well as consumers to reduce their spending habits in an effort to manage future risk. So if you think about it from the corporation standpoint, you know, one way to reduce spending is what we've seen and what we've talked about here on Monday Morning Minutes for previous episodes there, and the company layoffs that we've already seen make their way around. Largely first, I think, Jeff, we talked about it in terms of mortgage shops there, you know, just as you saw rates spike and purchase and refinance activity declined, it made sense that you'd start to see layoffs in that sector, especially after that big ramp up that they had post in the quarters post pandemic. But then also just in terms of reducing spending via the capital expenditure spending there. In terms of consumers, you know, perhaps you reduce the number of vacations or you eat out a little bit less if you do get the sense that an economic slowdown is coming, a la the inverted yield curve. So overall, you know, Professor Harvey was saying that it could be a self-fulfilling prophecy there in terms of the yield curve portending slower growth, because as you know, people reduce their spending, it does slow economic activity. But the bright side is that it potentially could reduce the blow-up risk of companies just, you know, going bankrupt from overspending and taking risky measures or activities during this period of potential economic slowdown.
Yeah, I was going to say that when you were discussing it, I was thinking, well, that's going to be self-fulfilling. If people, you know, start firing people and slow down their spending, then it's going to cause that's going to, you know, be much more of a cause for a recession, not a avoidance of a recession. But I think the idea would be that it's going to be a milder recession. It's going to be a shallower recession because it's much longer. People are anticipating it, as opposed to, you know, all the bad things happening all at once and everyone firing people and it building upon itself. If people get ahead of it a little bit, it becomes a shallower, and there's the you know, we could have a softish landing as opposed to a hard landing.
Yeah, and something that you just said there just rang a bell too when I was looking at an interview that you had. This was I didn't know this, but Professor Harvey's is a Canadian by birth. But he was doing an interview with one of the local media publications up there in Canada. And he was made mention, you know, first of the signal that it has here in the US, and was asked whether or not it works in Canada. And he said yes. But one special note there that he said in Canada is that not only does the inversion signal a potential recession coming in both countries, but it also in Canada at least, the depth and duration of the inversion also suggests the kind of the magnitude and depth and the duration of the recession in Canada. Though he did not say it worked in the US, he did say it worked in Canada. So just pulling it up on Bloomberg, I was eyeballing it, you know, didn't really pull down the data, but just doing a little lowballing there and saw that it does seem to kind of work, at least for the duration of said recessions, but I didn't get a chance to look into the magnitude. But if that's the case, thus far this level of inversion, at least through the twos, tens, which has been going on since continuously since July, and then when we take a look at it on the threes, tens, that's been going continuously since the first week of November, then that kind of gives you a sense of, you know, perhaps at minimum where this recession could go. And a lot of people are suggesting that it is, you know, perhaps shallower or albeit longer type of duration. So at least that duration seems to be holding up there. But if the magnitude is right, then I think that could be problematic, because I believe the level of inversion that we've seen across both these curves is pretty deep relative to what we've seen in the past. So, you know, from that standpoint, hopefully this that observation that worked in Canada doesn't work here in the U.S.
I was going to say a negative 100 basis points on the 3-month 10-year is not doesn't bode well for the
not at all. So that was the first reason. Just adjustments to potential behavior, given the fact that people are well aware of the slowing activity that the inversion brings, or the inversion signals, I should say. So the second reason that he provided was, just as you mentioned earlier, we do have a strong labor market. He says that the excess demand for labor means potentially easier, it'll perhaps be easier for those who have been laid off to find a new job. And then, given the fact that a lot of the biggest job cuts and thus far the ones that have been announced have largely been in the tech sector. And I guess with tech, I think he's also talking about some of those bigger names that are in the S&P 500 that are oftentimes considered tech, but they're actually in the consumer discretionary, consumer communication services side. But, you know, some of those bigger companies there, they have largely been highly skilled that have been fired. So the likelihood for them to find a job and turn it around perhaps it will be a little bit quicker than usual. But I know I'm a little bit skeptical on that. You know, it's something that we always like to say here is, you know, there's never just one cockroach. You know, perhaps it's the same for sector, because, you know, the tech side and real estate side kind of makes sense to see some layoffs there, because there's a lot of hiring immediately post pandemic in response to some of the demand needs that came out of there. But maybe some of that over hiring is not going to be rehired on the other side of this next kind of economic cycle here. So it's something to kind of watch for there. But on the surface level, it does sound kind of good. I mean, the labor market being strong, and we're talking about this JOLTS data in terms of being in excess over the number of unemployed, suggests that, you know, the hiring should be fairly strong, and labor market should be strong for the periods to come.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that you haven't seen, or at least you haven't seen on the headlines, is like the, to use an example, fast food workers. You haven't seen them laid off, but you also haven't, remember, when we were seeing the signs, like, you know, you would get a bonus if you worked there for a month, $1,000 bonus or $500 bonus or whatever it was. You don't see those types of signs anymore. And I think that part of the reason that you probably aren't seeing layoffs there is because, you know, those places had such a hard time hiring people that they're probably a little bit longer leash in terms of keeping their employees, because it was such a hard time to hire people. But I think certainly there's been a slowdown there because you're not seeing those high bonus, or at least I haven't seen those high bonus signs anymore that we were seeing a couple of years ago.
No, that's a good point. But one of the things I was also thinking about, when I read that statement of his, that it'd just be easier to find another job because they're highly skilled. I think that's the case if you're talking about, you know, perhaps a layoff situation that's more idiosyncratic in nature, company specific, and then you can find another company in the same industry and get hired pretty easy. But if it starts to become a systemic issue across that industry, then the chances of job hopping is reduced a little bit. And perhaps, sure, we've seen a little bit of that as well, you know, just in anecdotal evidence of, you know, when we see people that in the past used to ask for astronomical amounts for job interviews, and now they're just, you know, no longer asking for the, you know, work from home 3 days a week and days off for the rest of the four, you know, that type of thing at five times the salary. So as those anecdotes start to disappear, then you start to wonder too on the accuracy of that statement. Yep. And then the third reason that he provided is saying that consumers and financial sector are also stronger than they have been in previous recessions. And thus you could see less contagion from consumer defaults, or, you know, a lot of the housing market that we saw back in the 08 recession, and then also problems in the financial sector, kind of also similar to what we saw in the 08 recession as well, most recently, just given the poor underwriting. So I think there's some validity to that statement, but time will tell. I mean, I think a lot of that, again, depends on this jobs, the strength of the jobs market that we've been talking about, and hoping that continues. Yep. And then a fourth one he mentioned right now is, given that a lot of the problems that we've seen right now have been related to inflation and the response mechanism of the Fed in terms of trying to battle said inflation, that one good sign here that makes him think that perhaps this inversion could be a false signal is that the expectations for inflation versus current levels today are lower. So that in itself suggests that inflation easing over time, that should reduce the odd of having this so-called hard landing. Earlier on, I did say that this was kind of a clickbait in terms of the headline, because it did cause me to click it when it said that the economist said that his indicator that predicted 8 U.S. recessions is wrong this year. Perhaps he may have said that, but he also followed up in the fine print. When you take a look at the article, it does say that you know, when you take a look at these reasons, perhaps it does suggest that we can dodge the bullet and avoid this hard landing or a recession. But the likelihood is that we are going to realize slow growth and, you know, perhaps even minor negative growth. But if a recession does arrive, it will be mild. So, you know, there definitely was a concession on that. He does say that the big risk, though, is of the Fed continuing to hike and hiking hiking too much, that incrementally increases the risk of recession over time as well.
And I think that we would all agree with that.
Most definitely. So, it's one of those things where he recognizes it too. It just says, this is just a tool. You know, it's, you know, you're basically taking a, you're creating a model that's a simplification of reality. And, you know, you and I talk about it all the time. I mean, we have a number of tools in our kit, and, you know, sometimes, and we have these signals, and sometimes certain signals will flash red, others will flash green, and you just have to take a look at the whole picture and just really come to your own conclusion based on what the signals are indicating. But at the end of the day, it is just that. It's just an indication. You just have to make your own conclusions from the data points that you're parsing through.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting. He said that, you know, his model is it's a one factor model, and he doesn't think that a one factor model really is going to be indicative of the complexity of the U.S. economy. So right. at least he sees that. And, you know, as you said, Sam, it's just another input into the big model of that we try to incorporate all the as much information as we can without getting analysis paralysis. And something that, you know, we can use this model as another input into our thought process.
That's right. That's right. The univariate model that we all love and hold dear, right? So, but that's it. Yeah, I mean, it was just pretty interesting just to hear the, you know, you and I joke a lot about that this time is different, especially when it comes to the yield curve. So it was really interesting to hear it from the person himself. So, you know, we thought it was worth a little dive into the article and see what was being said.
Yeah, and he also put in, you know, to kind of end it, this is what I thought was interesting. He's like, you know, he knows, he said, you know, part of the skill is to know when to deploy the model and when not to. In other words, to know the limitations of the model. And maybe I'm in a good position to know the limitations, given that it's my model. So
that's right. That's right.
Well, when we get into the things to keep an eye on for next week, next week is a pretty quiet week. We do have the one big data point there on Thursday, being the CPI data coming out. Looking for this for December. Month over month, CPI is expected to be 0.0%, so flat versus the previous month. The previous month was up a tenth of a basis point, so decline, but flat. Core CPI expected to be up 30 basis points, so slight uptick from the 0.2% from last month, or from November. Those numbers would bring the year-over-year headline CPI to 6.6, so that's down a whopping 50 basis points, so from 7.1 to 6.6. And then that would bring core CPI to 5.7, down from 6.0. So, you know, if we do get those numbers, you can feel like the Fed is going to be fairly happy that inflation is moving in the right directions. Also on Thursday, we do get the jobless claims numbers. We didn't talk about them for last week, but they are continuing to trend down in a pretty stable pace. So look to keep an eye on those. And then on Friday, we get the University of Michigan inflation expectations. Those are expected to remain around 2.9%. So pretty quiet week, but certainly there could be some fireworks there around the CPI data point.
Yeah, it's always an interesting point to watch, especially at this point in time when, you know, people are talking about whether or not the Fed is going to start pausing or not. So time will tell.
If I remember correctly, I think Powell's speaking on Tuesday. Yes, on Tuesday, the 10th. So that could be, it's probably going to be more of the same, but certainly something to keep an ear out to see if he talks or how he's talking about the labor market and inflation.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, I see it. It's going to be in Sweden, it looks like. So that'll be interesting to see.
We're always looking, you know, there's a lot of Fed speak, but we're always trying to, you know, Powell obviously carries the most weight. So let's see what he has to say.
Yeah, I don't want to give too many spoilers, but we just recorded, you know, this roundtable prime that we do on an annual basis. And I won't give out the full numbers here, but Jim Bianco did say that Jerome Powell accounts for 75% of everything that we should be listening to in terms of importance there. The remaining 25% is pretty funny. So I'll leave it to that and let people tune into that once it's available on our YouTube platform.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's a good tease there, Sam. So I like that. I guess that wraps it up. And I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in.
Yeah, thanks everyone for listening to us on this first episode of 2023 of Monday Morning Minutes. Don't forget, you can pick up the latest episode each Monday before the bell. I'm going to jinx ourselves because every time I do this, it seems like there's a technicality that prevents it from happening. But for those of you who are listening and those of you who are very subscribed, then you'll know that oftentimes we actually release this on the Fridays in the early evening. So if you just can't wait until Monday before the bell, you know, perhaps you can listen to it Friday night, Saturday, or all day Sunday prior to that. So again, hopefully no jinx, we'll see if it holds, but I'm 2 for 2 in terms of jinxing it so far. So see if we can break it on this third time here. But Monday Morning Minutes is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts. If you can't find it there, hit us up on email at minutes@doubleline.com. You can also hit us up on the Twitter at DLine Minutes. Please send us any questions that you might want to submit for us to tackle on the topic of the week section, or if you have any comments. In the past, you know, people kept telling us that they couldn't hear us. So let us know if you can't hear us on these, or if you want us to try to improve the audio quality, we will if we can.
If they can't hear us, then they don't know that you just said that. All right. Don't forget to check. You can also get it on our website, doubleline.com. YouTube channel is youtube.com/doubleline capital. Keep an eye out there for, as Sam teased, for the roundtable prime. And then also make sure to follow Sam's other podcast that he does with Jeff Sherman on, you follow them on Twitter at Sherman Show Pod. Hope everyone has a great week.
Yeah, thanks everyone. And good luck out there.
Presentation represents DoubleLine's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media in any form without the expressed written permission of DoubleLine. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from DoubleLine, please contact media@doubleline.com. Neither DoubleLine nor any of its affiliates make any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Liability, including in respect of direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is expressly disclaimed. DoubleLine is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice in this podcast. The receipt of this podcast by any listener is not to be taken as constituting the giving of investment advice by any DoubleLine entity or individual to that listener, nor to constitute such person a client of any DoubleLine entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but does not imply low risk.
Copyright 2023, DoubleLine Capital.